Turuntuset tulee Joonel.
And our main topic today would be design as a strategy. And to introduce the topic, I would like to say that Designeer, or Design Night program, brought many high-level professionals to Estonia. And we had also a chance to host Michael Thompson from UK here. And he is the person who has helped a lot of companies, countries, to design the strategies. And today it's a very good chance for us to discuss it here in our talk show a bit more. And let's start from the beginning. Tell me, why would a country or a public organization or a company need a design strategy?
Thank you for asking me along to help with your conversation today. I think it depends who you're talking to. A country has a different need than a company, and a company has a different need than an organization. So I think if you're looking at a country is trying to understand how it might support economic and cultural growth, how it might be trying to strengthen its identity, how it might be trying to differentiate itself amongst a globalizing world of competitor nations. And many countries are now starting to see that design is a component or a strategy or an approach which can actually support better innovation. That's one way to look at it. And that's a way that politicians understand as well. I remember when I was president of BEDA, the Bureau of European Design Associations. I mean, my own business, Design Connect, is an independent business. I'm an independent freelancer, as it were. I've been working in this field for 20 years. And as a part of that, I was involved with BEDA. And BEDA had the opportunity and the goal to actually try and take design as a strategy to the European Commission. And back in 2008... we had the opportunity, after 10 years of developing a relationship with the Commission and the various directorates there, of speaking with the president of the Commission then, José Manuel Barroso. And his interest in design, and indeed the interest of the other directorates, was not for design itself, but because design was a very powerful supplement to other innovation strategies that already existed. So when we were talking as BEDA, when we were talking to the European Commission, we weren't saying, you know, design is the most important thing, you must do design, because if you don't, you're going to be in trouble or whatever. That would have been a naive approach. And I think that we had to understand, begin to learn how to speak the language of the Commission. And we had to understand what their goals and objectives were, and how we might find a way then that design as a strategy, as a way of looking creatively at the world, as bringing a customer-centred or a user-centric approach to policy making, might actually be supportive to the European Commission in building better innovation strategy and finding ways to get SMEs across Europe to uptake, to make use of design as a key strategy for growth. So I think those words, you know, around growth, about wealth creation, about development, about economic development and growth, all of those aspects were something which connected, I think, to the Europeans' agenda at that time. And just staying with this for a moment, the outcome of that was that in 2010, the European Commission integrated design into its innovation strategy for the first time. That in turn then unlocked some many millions of euros of funding support for the uptake of design under the European Design Innovation Initiative. And that process then allowed somewhere in the region of, I think it was 8 projects, to then be delivered across Europe, with many consortium partners across Europe taking part to try and help support and develop the climate for a more amenable understanding of what design can mean for companies. And I think that in itself has been a process of learning, and all of these things are opportunities for companies to confront their future challenges in a new way of thinking about them, not just in the sense of using methods and tools that they've used in the past, but to try and understand what this strange thing called design is, and how design is a way of thinking about the world and thinking about their customers might help them actually develop and grow better services and products. I think for companies, you've heard me saying that design can be a contributor to growth. And that is something that's been proven time and time again over the last 30 or 40 years. There's all sorts of examples. Of course, the big examples are the ones that we all hear about, you know, Apple, Johnny Ive and Apple, and you know, top-down, very strong design direction. People talk a lot about Google and Twitter. But I think it's interesting because although those large companies can shine a light as to what it might mean to be a very powerfully design-led company, actually, their reality is not the reality of the 400,000 SMEs across Europe. And it's those SMEs where I think those people are trying to understand who they are and what they're for, where they're trying to go and what they're trying to achieve for their customers. And they're trying to use design either implicitly, internally themselves, to communicate who they are more clearly, or by using external design support, whether that's graphic designers or brand strategy people or brand strategists working with marketing people or whatever it is, to try and actually get opportunities to make themselves very visible and accessible to their customers in a way that has qualities and values that are positive, or legible, so that people can understand the emotion of the emotional content of the product or service that they're engaging with. And I think then for organisations, as opposed to companies, for organisations, I think they have to have strategies which allow them to try and bring design into their companies, to embed design in the company as a way of behaviour. Now, of course, for many of your listeners, I'm guessing that many of them would have a particular interest in the marketing field.
Yes.
And of course, design will be something that's interesting to them. But a marketeer isn't necessarily a designer, and a designer isn't necessarily a marketeer. And I think there is, crossover, because the crossover comes because both those constituencies or those communities of professional practice have to think about their customers or their clients, whether they're in-house or consulting externally. They have to think about why they're doing what they're doing and where the company or the client they're working for needs to go next. So understanding purpose and direction, and understanding where those companies need to go in their journey of growth, whether that's a product development journey, whether it's a service development journey, maybe they're in working in environment or transportation or whatever sector they're working in. I think that the crossover comes when they're helping change the culture of the client that they're working with to help them become more successful at what they do.
Can you tell me a couple of good stories about one about the country using a design strategy and what does it exactly mean? And the second one about the company, probably a small and medium-sized, who does something based on design and gets good results?
I think the... the thing is that every case is probably different. I think there are a number of countries which are well known for having design strategies or design policies. And there's another nice little distinction I'd like to make here. When BEDA went to the European Commission, we originally went and asked for, we were saying Europe should have a design policy. We should have a policy on design. And we came to realise that that was probably unrealistic and actually not as effective or efficient as design in policy. So that all policies can be, you know, a policy for social healthcare could have a design element in it, which is making it more user-centered, thinking about the end users more carefully. So that was a nice distinction. And I think a lot of the front or forward thinking for design policy, if you were to ask people in the know, I suppose they might say that Finland, for example, was a very early adopter of having design strategies or design policies. The UK, interestingly, does not have a clear design strategy, but it does have a design council at the national level. Estonia had a policy written in 2008, I think it was, by Per Mollerup, which looked at focusing what Estonia's strengths are and how you could actually get synergies from that in the future. And he made some recommendations which looked at the development of the Estonian Design Award, an icebreaker program to help companies actually make use of design for the first time, to use designers, which of course helps grow the design sector too. And that was the Bulldozer program, and also then design awareness raising seminars and workshops and so on. And I think that a lot of success has taken place in that. You know, the Estonian Association of Designers. I'm here this week because I've been speaking at their Tallinn Design Festival. We had a very good conference yesterday with very good contributions from a number of speakers. And I think that the countries that are paradoxically that are strongest in terms of developing design policy are probably the countries of the Far East. So South Korea has had policy development, a specific design policy, which is launched by the president of South Korea every 5 years in the Blue House. I had the opportunity to attend on one occasion. And that policy has, every 5 years, has taken a different approach to trying to create a step change in what South Korea could achieve in terms of becoming aligned with advanced industrial societies like those of the West, or some of those of the West. So I think that's been a very strategic and very long-term approach to developing design policy in South Korea. China is looking to develop policies at the moment, and they're talking, I've heard some people from Tongji University talking about design policy 4.0, where they're trying to say that China is trying to leapfrog current understandings of what design might mean in society and in industry, and they're trying to now encapsulate that in new ways. So I think this field is very broad, and there's a lot happening in the field at the moment. The European Commission, I have to say, was very quick to respond to us. Once we got to our meeting with Mr. Barroso and Gunther Verheugen at that time, they were very quick to respond and responded well. And I think they absolutely get and understood why design might be important for the sort of economic health of a nation, which is a marvellous stride forward. I mean, that 10, 15 years ago, that was unimaginable. We just couldn't envisage that would happen in the way that it did. If we look to companies, I mean, there's so many examples of companies, whether it's, I mean, if we think of Swedish companies or Finnish companies, Scandinavian companies have a very strong focus on human scale and social agenda, and that makes them very open to designing products that really fit with people's lifestyles, if it's lifestyle products we're talking about. If we look at the automotive sector, of course, I mean, they're a remarkable sector using design all the time because, of course, people interface so immediately with all of their products, whether it's luxury brands or mid-car range brands or whatever. And I think if I was talking about a company that I've been working with, which is a global company, it's family owned, it's based in Scandinavia, and that's Echo Shoes. And they have a very sophisticated design leadership team internally. I've been working with them across 5 divisions now for a few years. And they work very creatively and very hard to try and integrate technology, craftsmanship, the qualities of leather. They've got the most remarkable capability and capacity in leather. Actually, Echo is one of the few companies, assuming I'm allowed to mention a specific company name, they're one of the few shoe companies that actually own the leather from the field to the market, as it were. And they've appointed a new creative director recently, Liam Maher, and he and his design director, Nikki Tasonen, are driving innovation into the company. And they also have set up, about 3 years ago, they set up an innovation centre, and that's based outside of Denmark. So those companies are trying to use design and creativity as a way to really get to the roots of who they are and where they come from and how they can use that as a springboard for actually developing new and new products that people really want to have. And I know that I'm sure you may have seen it in some of their stores. You know, their positioning strategy at the moment is around perpetual natural motion. And that's a way of trying to fuse the duality of the craftsmanship from our tradition in the past with what the technology and materials can do for the future. So I think that's a very exciting outcome. Echo is not an Apple. It doesn't get quoted a lot in Wall Street Journal. You know, all these American journals, you know, Fast Company and Wired and all the rest of it, forever are going on and on and on about Airbnb and Uber and all the rest of it. But those are not representative companies, although they represent a wave that's coming and a new way of companies organizing themselves in society. Nevertheless, I don't think they're representative of the vast engines of economic growth that exist in the various countries of Europe. Or elsewhere, actually. Absolutely. Or maybe from North America.
When I ask about, you told that Finland was one of the first countries implementing design strategy. What was it, and why? What did they decide to do differently? Because probably by now we see that Finland is successful, but probably outsiders haven't decoded the process.
Well, I don't have the Finnish policy to hand with me now. I think they're actually
just in general terms.
I think they're rewriting it at the moment. Actually,
okay.
I haven't seen any of the drafts of that. Generally speaking, those policies try to support the growth of the design sector.
Okay.
They try to support communication about and raise awareness about the value of design and how design can be incorporated into companies. Because, of course, companies, I think it's almost like a market failure. You know, if you go to many companies and ask them, do you think design is important? They will say yes, but then when you ask them how much they spend on design, you'll probably find that that is not matched. There isn't a match there. There's a mismatch. And that's very often because there are barriers to companies being able to assimilate and adopt design as a strategy into their organizations. So I think a lot of the work that these, a lot of the outcomes that these policies are trying to achieve is almost a shift in perception of the company owners, of organization directors, who are actually more open then to bringing design as a strategy into their organizations. Now, one of the key changes in the last, five, six, 7 years has been Tim Brown at IDEO's work on design thinking, or this introduction of the idea of design thinking, which is more about being creative, open-ended, consumer-oriented, able to take failure as a learning step rather than a disaster, managing risk, thinking outside the box, all of those visualizing ideas and concepts, constellating categories of customers, being much more focused on experience rather than product. That, in other words, the product becomes a servant to the experience that you're trying to create through that product. The design thinking has been a very powerful opportunity or idea. Actually, it's such a clever idea because it means that many people who have no reason to have any understanding about design, they have no education in design, they might be making things, but they've no formal understanding of what design might mean other than perhaps at levels of engineering function, for example, where design really doesn't play a significant part in the sense that I'm talking about it in terms of a holistic appearance of a product or manifestation of a product or a service that actually really integrates and interfaces well with the people that are using. This is the same for software products as well, of course. So that opportunity to bring a raised level of awareness is something that these policies are trying to do. So okay. There's design policy generates support for design. So design support mechanisms. So that might be award schemes. It might be opportunities to place designers into companies, maybe initially at some form of pilot market rate, as it were. It might take the form of, I think one of the things that Finland have done is they've taken design savvy or design trained people and put them into government departments.
Oh, okay.
They had, of course, in Finland, Marco Steinberg's Helsinki Design Lab for a while, which became like a neutral space where a number of people could actually come together and meet to actually look at very apparently intractable problems, particularly problems with a social agenda to them. Or, for example, in Denmark, Christian Basson, as he was then, he's now the director of the Design Council, but in Denmark, but he was head of Mind Lab, and that became a neutral space that could take inside government for governments to allow governments to actually, as civil servants, step outside their normally risk-averse, slow pace of change, understandably because they're using taxpayers' money. But how can you create an experimental space inside a culture where these organisations can then start to innovate how they approach the service development, public sector development, which is a much more closer focus on what customer needs are rather than what political needs are. I originally come from Bangor in Northern Ireland, and the Northern Ireland Civil Service has an innovation lab as well. And there's a number of innovation labs in many different parts of the world now as a way, as a method or as a tool to help organisations think differently about how they create and generate services, products and services. I know in the public sector, in local authorities, very often it's the case that there's a slightly dysfunctional mismatch, because the people that are tasked with creating a new service are not necessarily the same people that are tasked with delivering the service. So there's a sort of a slight silo mentality can emerge. And I think there are, I mean, Lambeth Council, for example, in the UK has done a lot of work trying to integrate across the silos to get a more seamless way of working internally, where the focus and alignment of people's energy and their tasks is on what do our customers need? What is it that they need? What are their needs? How do you get customer insight? How do you gather customer insight? How do you avoid consultation fatigue, for example? There are all sorts of questions that some of these authorities are now starting to look at themselves in a very different way about being customer focused rather than necessarily, as I said earlier, you know, politically focused or delivery focused or whatever. There's so many other ways that they can be engaged other than the more holistic approach to thinking about the consumer. And it's those authorities that are thinking more carefully about the needs of their users. And involving the users in that decision-making process. I'm sure you've heard talk of co-creation and co-design, of course. I mean, the more insight you can get from your customers as early in the process as possible, then the better that is as well.
Absolutely.
For the outcomes.
From my mind, a big challenge is also about how to implement the policy or the strategy mm-hmm. within a company. Mm-hmm. Especially in Estonian, we have a problem because our people think that design is a well-designed logotype mm-hmm. or a nice picture or a nice advertising mm-hmm. announcement. This is what most of the people think that it is a design. Mm-hmm. And when I have a company and someone from the top management comes and says, hello guys, now we need a design policy mm-hmm. and now we are going to implement, and then everyone thinks that he's probably crazy. We don't need a new logo. Okay, let him draw the new logo. We'll put it on the material. That's it. So this is the perception often what we face mm-hmm. here in Estonia. How to overcome it?
Well, I think, the first thing I think you have to do is acknowledge that is the perception that is here, and that's not a wrong perception. As such, you don't want to make those people wrong in that. They are who they are. They are where they are now because of where they've come from. I think what's helpful if you're trying to create cultural change is to connect to where people are. You don't want to be standing somewhere way ahead of them and saying, look, you should be here now. You should be doing this. I think it's much more subtle and much more effective to work with those people as closely as possible to say, look, actually, there are other ways to approach this. And there might be some things that you're missing here. There might be some opportunities that you're missing. And there are some paradoxes. It sounds a bit crazy, this thing, design, because it's intangible. It's a bit more than just a logo. So if you're trying to talk to people about intangibles, particularly people who are very operational, people who are very focused on manufacturing or making things, then it can be difficult for them to step back and abstract their perception of themselves and say, well, actually, we could think about ourselves differently. We could communicate ourselves differently. And it's a bit more than just a badge. And I think trying to help people step up the ladder, as it were, of sophistication in terms of how they can integrate design into their organisations is a task that's unique to every company. I mean, my work for, 20 years now, every company I go to, it's different, the story is different. And talking about ladders, of course, there is the Danish Design Ladder, again, I'm sure known to many of your listeners, developed by the Danish Design Council in 2003. And in fact, I think it was Christine Melander there who was doing some work with SMEs in Denmark. And she thought, do you know what? I need something to help our local SMEs understand where they are on the journey of either of moving from not having any design in their company towards design as strategy. And she created the Danish Design Ladder. And I'm sure if she'd been able to protect that idea, she'd have been a millionaire by now. So if you're listening, Christine, I'm sorry you aren't. But you know, she had this four-step ladder because it's been copied all over the world, and I use it a lot in work. It's very, very simple, and it's very straightforward, and we talked about it at the conference yesterday. You know, you're moving from no design to a perception of where there's no design plays no role in product or service development. In terms, remember, don't be offended if you're an engineer listening. I'm not talking about engineering design. I'm talking about the design that actually interfaces directly with people and how that engineering technology is made real and humanized for people. So the design plays no role in product service development. That then goes to design as styling, which is where design, somebody might say, well, I'll tell you what, why don't we make the buttons on the front blue? That would be quite nice, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be nice? So that's sort of design styling, which suggests a surface approach. And I think the next step up the ladder then is design as a process. And that starts to mean that you begin to treat it as a manageable, intangible asset inside the company. So you start to bring management approaches to delivering and managing design as a process within your company. That starts to mean you need to think about resources and people and time, and you need to think about, well, what is it you're trying to do and why? And then, of course, as you get better at that, it might be then at that stage you're starting to use external designers, or you've built an in-house design team, or you're starting to build one. And then you start to move that. It becomes more embedded in the culture. It suddenly, you know, it becomes like, how could we ever have done without this? Our customers appreciate it. It's not always easy. It's not always a straight line. You're still on a learning curve. But actually, at the end of the day, once people have discovered this thing called design and start to find ways to bring it into their companies, then that makes a big difference. And in fact, the British Design Council did a design innovation service for technology companies some years ago, and they did a semi-longitudinal approach to bringing designers into organisations to help them think about their product and software development. And of those, 80% changed their strategic direction by becoming confronted with design.
Really?
And that accelerated them towards a customer rather than a technology focus. The bit that interests me is that 80% reported a changed mindset, culture and vision. And I think that's powerful. You know, there's that lovely phrase that somebody once said, that when the brain once expanded never returns to the same shape. And I think that's a bit the same for companies that use design. You know, 75% invested significantly in design are confident of a return on investment, and 50% saw better management or a reduction in commercial risks, and 35% changed product or service. So I think this idea that once you start to go into an organization and you take a holistic view to who they are, what they're for, what is their purpose, what is their vision, where are they trying to get to, what is it in the world they're trying to change, and how are they going to do that? Then I think once you stand back and ask searching questions around that, and then in turn at the same time also ask searching questions about their customers. Who are your customers now? Who do you want your customers to be in future? How well do you know your customers? What sort of behaviours do your customers show? What sort of trends might you be seeing on the horizon that you think, well, actually that's something we can learn from or grow from? You know, all of these questions actually give a different framework within which a company and its senior management team can perceive what it is they're trying to do and why. And I think that is as much about design as actually giving form to an idea or delivering a design concept around a new product opportunity or whatever, a new technology opportunity. So I think that idea of design changing culture and design informing change in culture and helping support good change, good design and good change, is something that I'm very passionate about. And again, we talked about this yesterday at the conference as well, and there were some other speakers talking about, for example, design making a change in cities. City design is becoming very important. It's becoming, there's the UNESCO Design Cities Network, which has, I can't remember how many cities now, a good many cities around the world, where they're trying to use design to promote the city. You've got the World Design Organization's World Design Capital Programme. Torino was the first World Design Capital in 2008, and I had the good fortune to sit on the advisory group for that, the steering group for that. And since that time then, we've had Helsinki and Taiwan, and Seoul was also World Design Capital, and the next one coming up is Mexico City next year. So I think this idea, this additional idea, not just of growth being about economic growth and design being a support for that, or design being a support for innovation in companies, which is what we were talking to the European Commission about, or within policies, is also this idea that design itself is a very useful way to help companies learn how to find or unfold their new future and stay alive to what it is their customers need, because they can become irrelevant quite quickly if they're Absolutely. Not if they're not focused on their customers.
Absolutely. Let's say the first three steps, what I need to do as a company manager, if I say that, or owner, yeah, probably in Estonian schemes, I want to implement this. So I need to understand where we are now, was the first, mm-hmm. probably put on the ladder mm-hmm. somewhere.
Yes.
Okay. And then let's say that probably the most of the companies are on the second level. Let's mm-hmm. say that design as a styling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably the blue buttons would be nice. Yeah,
yes.
On this
mm-hmm.
level. So we think now that the blue buttons will be nice, and we would discuss maybe the green and yellow buttons.
Mm-hmm.
But what should we do instead?
Yes, well, I think what... I mean, it may well be that blue buttons are absolutely exactly what's needed. But... In the case where the blue buttons aren't necessarily what's needed, I think what's interesting about that is it's the mind behind, it's the perception of what that means. So what that means is that culture is focused on one particular aspect of a product, and it's a functional, technical, mechanical aspect. Okay, so they're colouring it, but it's still a switch or a button. And it suggests that they're taking a fragmented view, both of the product itself, if we're talking about a product, but also a fragmented view of the customer experience of that product. And they're not standing back and thinking holistically about what that product might mean in a wider sense, and where innovation can lie. What are the right questions you could be asking your customers to find where innovation can lie? Quite a lot of research has been done about why SMEs don't use design. What are the barriers to design? And the barriers to companies using design. And a lot of those barriers relate to, we don't know how to do it. We don't know where to find it. And our perception is that it's really, really expensive. So all of those are mindset issues. The expensive issue is... do they also say that about marketing, for example?
Yeah,
marketing's really expensive. They do, don't they? Whereas, in fact, we all know, okay, I know there's that story about 100% of marketing. What is it? You know that 50% is quite good, works well, and 50% maybe doesn't work so well, but nobody knows which 50%. I mean, it's also true that for design, that you can perceive it either as a cost or an investment. And if it's an investment, then that's about something that's actually growing the company. And that's a different way of thinking about expenditure, isn't it, as an investment? So if you're trying to invest in something that's going to help you move forward, then that's a more positive way to look at that, a more holistic way, a strategic way to look at that for the business. With regard to the how, again, every company is different. I think there are opportunities for companies to say, well, first of all, we need to think about what this might mean for us. So it might be, for example, I've worked with senior management teams where they've sat down, and not in very large companies, I'm talking companies maybe 20, 30, 40 people. I've also worked with companies with thousands of people in them. But even for small or medium-sized companies, it's still possible for the senior management team to take a bit of time out, a half day out somewhere, and say, well, how can we develop our innovation strategy? How can we become more closer to our customers? Are we on the right track? Is this the right path that we are on? And if it's not the right path, then where does the opportunity lie? If we were going to start this company now, would we do it differently than when we first started it? You know, so there's some very simple, deceptively simple questions that you can ask of yourself, or better still, get somebody in to facilitate it for you. To help you actually then to map out a more visionary approach to where you could be in the future. And once you've mapped out that roadmap, bit like the sigmoid curve, you know, where you have the bell curve and you don't want to go into decline. So you try to create a new narrative mm-hmm. and create a new bell curve going up from that. Then that's what you want to try and do as well in that situation. In terms of hiring designers, there are all sorts of supports in most of the countries of Europe to help companies find design, either through national design councils or through professional design associations, through the web, this thing called Google. There are opportunities to actually source the sort of design expertise you need, because that is the other thing that stops companies using it, is they don't know where, they don't know where to find design. Again, that is something that just with some fairly straightforward searching, you could at least find, if not the answer, you could find other people who could help you find the answer. And whether that's something that's very sectoral or very specific, I think you'll find that there are many consultancies across Europe, including in Estonia, who have tremendous skills and are able to help companies take a fresh view of themselves and what they do and create new opportunities.
Very good. Thank you a lot for this insight. I think that it's encouraging. I really suggest Estonian companies, even if you maybe don't understand exactly what the design is, but to have a chance and take a different look, because the world is changing and you have to change, otherwise it's just too late.